Well, it's good to be with you. It's nice that you turned off the snow machine in time for me to get me out of town. I'm sure that's what it was. But it's lovely to be a part of your congregation for the weekend. Those of you who've never heard me before, your run of good luck has now ended. You can tell by the way I talk that I come from Detroit, Michigan. That's where I've been for the last 8 years at least. Interestingly enough, I told this at the seminar as well, but I gave a seminar in East Tennessee, and a lady came up to me after one of my talks and said she loved my accent because she'd never heard anybody from Michigan before. And I told her, well, there you are, you know. Actually, the people in Michigan have a very strange accent. I've often said that if a northern Michigan person married a Palestinian, they would name their kid Yasser, you betcha. That's... And I do an awful lot of traveling about the place, and people will say, you must enjoy that. And the answer is, no, not so much. I enjoy my family. But the Lord, when you get with the Lord, he puts you in some odd positions. And never so much than the one I did a few years ago, right after Katrina. They decided to do a youth rally on the coast of Louisiana. And they asked if I would fly down to do it. And I said, sure, why not? And I got in a plane, landed in Memphis, because when you leave Detroit and you want to go south, you have to go through Memphis. And if you've lived an evil life, you stay in Memphis. The city's lovely, but the airport, people, brown brick, that's where it went to die. And I look out, and the storms are all around us, and they have these little airplanes there that are not much bigger than that little tube they use at the bank, you know, little thump thing. And I'm thinking, well, the storms are going to kill this. There's no way they're going to let us fly out. And they called my flight. And I was going, all right, fair enough. So we had to walk outside during the storm, you know, and I was got by a tall person in case, you know, lightning. And I got into it. And there's one of these very, you were kind of leaning over. It was one of those small things. And I was thinking, well, they'll never even start this thing. They're just going to send us back in. Well, they started an engine. I was going, all right, fair enough, they have to run the air conditioner because we're dying out here. But it can't be. They cannot take off in this weather, and they did. We were not 100 feet off the deck before we started swinging like this. And I was already praying hard against for the pilot and banging up. Literally, the next day I had bruises from being banged against the side of this thing. The flight attendant had a jump seat, and she never got out of it. And she's facing us. In the crash position, which did nothing for morale. She only spoke to us twice. Once was to say, there's no beverage service on this flight. And the other was to say, there'll be no going to the bathroom on this flight. And I'm thinking, lady, I'm not so sure. I mean, God bless you, but there's only so much you can control. And as I was in the airplane bouncing about the skies, I heard a young man behind me say something which I had never heard anybody actually say before. I'd heard people talk about saying it. But he turned to the man next to him and he said, would you mind if I shared with you the difference Jesus has made in my life? And I was thinking, well, good for him. You know, he wants to make one more convert. And I felt guilty there for a while because I was just full of hate and venom. I wasn't looking for... But then I thought, no, wait a minute. I believe in baptism. It's too late for everybody in the plane. You know, it's at that point, it's not evangelism. It's teasing, isn't it? So I just sat back and relaxed. And I thought, well, I'll be nice. If I find us hurtling toward water, I'll bring it up. You know, I'll say, you might want to listen to this. Repeat after me. Not much for traveling, but there is a travel motif in Scripture that I want to talk about today, a journey motif. Now, my congregation is way more than half of them had no church 5 years ago. And so we got 1,100 very squirrely individuals, and that includes the staff. And therefore, we sometimes use very Scripture-intensive studies where they have to, everybody turns, people are running about showing you where it is in the Bible. But other times we do this kind of lesson, which is a story lesson to help you try to put together several stories and make sense of them. But to start this, I have to use a phrase, which means everybody who's a teenager and younger, I'm going to lose immediately, because it's the phrase you're never allowed to use with this group. Back when I were a lad, back when I was young, Sunday afternoons were death on television. Absolute death. There was nothing to see. There was not like, well, we'll watch a ball game. There was the game of the week. Do you remember these days? American TV was terrible, but in Britain, it was worse. All of them shut down but one, and it would be cricket. And we'd call in, shut down. We'd rather see the test pattern with a wee girl holding a puppy. You know. And over here, though, it was you might actually go through high school and never see your team on TV. And so you didn't know what it was going to be. But mainly on Sunday afternoons, it was things like roller derby and wrestling and old Tarzan movies. Now, we weren't allowed to watch the roller derby or the wrestling because my father is my father. So we watched instead. We would watch the Tarzan movies, which were only evil, racist, and stupid. Those we were allowed to watch. So we would watch the Tarzan movies, and every single Tarzan movie, there is a scene where our intrepid hero has seen or touched or been or done something he's not allowed to see, touch, be, or do, or whatever, and he is now running because, shall we say, the natives are restless. And you will see him going through the jungle, and every so often, he'll kind of pause and and he'll run again, right? And every so often, he'll pause again. You'll hear this. Because you know they're coming. Oh, it's terrifying. This is in an Indiana Jones movies. It's in a mall, right? And our hero will then burst out of the jungle. And all of a sudden, he'll come to the edge of what? Thank you, you've seen the movie. This helps. Now, he'll even rock a wee bit, you know, because he's almost over the edge. And a bit will break loose and dramatically. It's very high. Now he's in trouble. And he's thinking, but here's... And so he runs and he finds a way across. It's a rope bridge. Yeah. This is not an OSHA-approved bridge. He's looking for the union label. He's not finding it. He'll test it a wee bit. I don't know. And he kind of launches out on it, and he gets about halfway across when he, what? Oh, it breaks. He almost falls. Right. That's the way it goes. I watched the first Indiana Jones movie in the village of Kilmarnock, Scotland. A little tiny little wee place. And my wife and I are sitting there, and there's this guy beside us, which is basically a coat with a hat on. I couldn't see any actual person. And Indy about slips, and he grabs my arm. Well, you don't do that. We're Scottish. We don't touch. So we play bagpipes to keep you out of here. Go away. He grabbed, and I looked over, and he goes, do you think you'll make it? And I looked at him, and I said, it's 5 minutes in, and they named the movie after him. I'm not understanding the tension here. Well, every sermon somehow teaches us about this journey. It will say, God is so wonderful and pure and holy and sinless, perfect. And fair enough, we're right. But then we'll go all the way over here. This is where we are. Nasty, stinky, sinful, yucky people. All right, fair enough. That's true too. Then I'll say, and the way to get over there is a perilous journey. You might not make it. You might start out with all good intention, and the rope bridge is going to break. You've got to know all of the right things. There are so many Christians that are terrified. There's going to be a pop quiz on the other side, and an angel's going to say, now, about the book of Zephaniah. And you're going to go, Zephaniah? Nobody reads Zephaniah. That's not true. It wasn't in the syllabus. I'm good with Acts 2:38. Ask me about Acts 2:38. And we're terrified of the unchecked box. We're terrified. We're going to get, you know, I love the Lord. I want to head toward Jesus Christ. And you get about to hear, and you see a pretty girl, and you go, hey, oh, and you're off the bridge. Or you spent your money the wrong way, and God goes, I don't approve of that. And he throws you away. Or you go, and you sang the wrong song. whatever that is. And the sad thing is, several of you thought of one. And boom, and you're off. And there was another song on the radio that you should not have been humming along to. Woof, there you go. And we don't, you'll never make it. That's pretty much the story I was told. I was told that there's not so much a book of life as a blackboard of life. And God is handy with the eraser. So you're in, you're out. Literally, you could be a Christian and not five or six times during the day. Anybody else remember these? That's the story we are told. But I want to tell you a little bit different story about this. But to do this, I need to go back to one of my favorite guys in all of the scripture, and that's Jacob. Jacob was a con man from the day he was... Well, he was a con man before he was born. And he stuck with it. I admire that. I admire somebody who knows who they are. And then, what does he do? Well, he cons people. But he conned, finally, the wrong guy too many times. He conned his brother. And his brother Esau was big and hairy and muscular and athletic. Everything Jacob was not. Jacob was the guy that sits in the kitchen with his mother going, hello. You know, and this is... He is not ready. And his mother gives him advice, says, run. So, oh, and he runs. Esau's tracking him, but he's running, run, till he's so tired, he falls asleep and uses a pillow, a rock as his pillow. Right, you know this, you're church people. Right, good. All right. Now, he dreams. And he dreams of this ladder going up to heaven. A connection between us and the eternal. And angels are going up and down on it, and they're getting their marching orders from God. They're coming down doing stuff. They're going back up and reporting to God. That's a great thing. By the way, we now know that King James got it wrong, because we've learned other manuscripts alike. We now know the word there is not ladder. It was stairway, which I think is so cool that God had a stairway to heaven so long before Led Zeppelin ever thought of it. I'm a guitar guy, and I hang around with guitar guys. And I just think that's so cool. You know, study the scripture, learn your guitar, and maybe you can... Anyway, but not here. But then... sorry. I just felt a breeze as I left the bridge. Anyway, you go all the way to John chapter 1. It's like a Celtic knot, this. It'll all come together. John chapter 1. And here comes a man to Jesus by night. And a lot of people make a big deal of that. He came at night. He must have been afraid. Sometimes you work during the day. So he came at night. Jesus liked him. Jesus was very impressed with this fellow. He didn't look upon him as a coward or anything. And he said, I promise you, one day you will see the heavens opened and the angels ascending and descending on me. Oh, wait a minute. Now that changes everything. God is so pure and so wonderful, and we are so absolutely not, and don't really have much of a chance of being anything but we are, but what we are. But the connection between us is not a rope bridge. It's Jesus Christ. Now that changes everything. Because he's not going to drop us. He's not going to kick us off. Look at the people he hung around with. I had somebody this weekend goes, do you guys really go into bars and clubs to talk to people? Yeah, we do. They'll say, how do church people get away with that? I said, I don't know. They've been hassling us ever since Jesus tried it. It's just, they still want to convert everybody that looks and thinks like them. You know, we're trying to convert everybody else, you know, and it's which is great. Leave it to us. We'll go for it. You know, we have a lot of people fit in those places, unfortunately. We celebrate recovery. We have coming and going. Let's put it that way. Here, Jesus is going to be our bridge. Now, this takes us back to an interesting word. Paul in Timothy, when talking to Timothy, says there is one mediator between God and man, even the man, Jesus Christ. Now, why is that important? Well, he used a word there for mediator that's only used one time in the Old Testament. Now, before you get all excited and go, wait a minute, the Old Testament was Hebrew, New Testament was Greek. Yeah, but Paul's favorite version of the Old Testament was in Greek. It was a Septuagint. That's when he quoted most of the time. So this word he used when he's writing to Timothy, that there's only one who stands between God and man, and that's Jesus Christ, is only used one time in the Old Testament. And it shows up in the book of Job. So let's talk about Job. If I say Job and you say patience, you've not read the book. He's patient for about 2.5 chapters. Then he's not patient anymore. He went from, if God would have had a dog, Job would have kicked it. He was angry. He was upset. Well, of course, he went from everything to nothing. The most tragic story you can think of. Lost his children, lost his reputation, lost his health. Literally from top of the world to, we don't know how long it took, but whatever it was, we now find him sitting in a pile of ashes, scratching at sores with a broken bit of pottery, while his wife is leaning over him going, curse God and die. I don't do Mesopotamian, so I had to make her English. Hope that's all right. Anyway, well, I think evil. Anyway, sorry. I'll go paint myself blue and scream here in a bit. That's all right. Those of you who haven't seen the movie have no clue. He went to nothing. His counselors get a good kicking from all of us, but his counselors didn't say anything we don't say every day to people. They gave their best shot. He says this, though, Job. One day, I know there is a Redeemer for me. And that's the word that Paul used. But it's not technically Redeemer. It's a different word. The word there literally is daysman. And that's what I want to talk to you about. Daysman. Daysman. This is something we didn't quite understand until about 20 or 30 years ago. Whenever people found this stuff in the British Museum. The British have for many years gone around the world and seen lovely things and then stolen them and taken them home and put them in the museum. You can go, if you go to the British Museum, you can walk past the gates that Daniel walked by as he went to work every day. They're there. And they have so many, it's something like 90% of all the documents they have not yet been translated. They have too many. But they translated and they found the story of the daysman. Now you remember the book of Ruth. That Boaz was her redeemer, a kinsman redeemer. There was another one that was first in line, but when he found out what it would cost his family, he bailed. So Boaz stepped up. It's very close to this, but it's not quite the same. Let's put it to you this way. Here's how a daysman would work. Remember, there's no Bill of Rights. The book of Job is way early. It is probably our oldest book. Not our oldest story, but our oldest book. There's no mention of Jerusalem, the law, Moses, the tribes, nothing of that. It's before all of this. The world's still drying out at this point, right? It's still, you know, a rough place. In fact, ice shows up a lot in the desert in Job's time. He'll talk about the ice and snow and how the Lord is at work in the north. And it's a terrifying thing for them and how the earth is still shaking. Well, all of this, he's working blind. All right, he's got nothing. He has no Bill of Rights. He has no law. He has no priesthood to go to. And you had to work. Some of you are old enough to remember this because although for us it's normal to play, for us, our grandparents and our parents, I never saw my dad play a game. There was no time. You had to work all day to have enough money and food to live to work all day the next day, right? Some of you remember this. Now our kids play and sometimes parents get mad at that. You know, you should be doing something constructive. Well, what do you want them to do? Build a road? You know, they got time. It's all right. Let them play. You know, we'll say things like, when I was a kid, the only thing I had was an orange and I was happy. Sure you are. That's how you turned into that big ball of sweetness. But they didn't have time to do a trial. And Job wants a trial with God. And there's no trial. You need a daysman to have a trial. He's looking for a daysman. Here's the way it would work. Let's say that there is a dispute between Terry and I. He had asked me to paint his house. And I painted his house. And he gave me $300 for it. I say he told me $3,000. That's a considerable dispute. Now, we can't settle it on our own, and there's no time to take this to trial. There are no trials. What you need is a daysman. We go to Shane, We both respect Shane, and we ask him, would you be our day's man? Now, this is something that's very important. Both people had to respect the individual, but the individual also had to put himself at risk. He was losing a day, hence the name day's man, of work, but he was also putting himself between two disputants. And if at the end of the day, we cannot agree, by putting himself there, he is saying, I will make up the difference. So if we don't move, he's out a hunk of change. And in case you are wondering, yes, in capital cases, it was the same. If Terry says, you killed that person on purpose, my family member on purpose, and I say, no, it was an accident, and we get somebody in between us, this is before the city's a refuge. If we cannot agree, that person is sacrificing their life. Normally not killed. Normally they were made a slave of the individual in your place. It was dangerous to be the day's man. And so when Job cries out, I need a day's man, no wonder his friends say, nobody will do that. Nobody. But we found a carving of a day's man at work. A day's man, to make sure things moved along, would stand between the two disputants with one hand on one and one on the other until the price was paid. Does this look familiar to anybody? And Job was saying, I want a day's man. And Paul says, you've got one. When I wake up in the morning, I'm not a Christian. I know some of you are. Some of you wake up singing hymns and, you know, I don't like you, but you do. Not much I can do about it. It takes me a while to become a Christian. I'm complaining and moaning and avoiding all mirrors, you know, and, getting in the shower and, you know, just going, Lord, just come now. That's all. The first thing I say in the morning when I wake up is literally, oh, still this side of the dirt. You know, I'm so ready. I hear people say, I'd like to live to be 100. Not me. No. No, in fact, when my daughter became a nutritionist, she was heading to be a dietitian at one time before she veered and now's in education. But I said, it's all right. A dietitian's a lovely individual, but don't be a food Nazi because everybody dies of something. So my philosophy is to study all diseases. Pick the one you want to die from and eat accordingly. So, I do not want to be in the hospital one of these days dying of nothing in particular. I don't want to see a bunch of doctors going, well, we just don't know what's wrong. I want it to be so obvious that when they walk in, they go, whoa, okay, got it. That's what I'm going for. I'm not good in the morning, but I'm going to tell you something. If I tripped and fell on the way into the bathroom, hit my head and died, I'm going to heaven because he said I am. I'm not on a rope bridge. I'm not going to get a doctrinal quiz at the end of things. Too many people move their Jesus one side or the other. They move him too far over here to where all he is Christmas Jesus, little baby Jesus, Talladega Nights Jesus, absolutely of no value to anybody. My son's a Marine. He's a big, tough guy. You hear people say, send in the Marines. You never hear anybody say, we're in trouble. Send in the baby. That doesn't help us. Or they'll move Jesus over here to where really he's just God light. And he doesn't even like us much. And so it's more like Jesus is over here with the angels playing a game of Red Rover, send Patrick right over. Like, see if he can get past us. He's not really on your side. Where's the scripture? Says he died for you. He loves you. Nobody will snatch you out of his hand. That he thinks for you. That he lives to intercede for us. Have you ever thought you make God tired by your prayers? Have you ever thought you're wearing him out? That he's up there going, again? Two things. One, Jesus lives for this. It's like, yes, I'm happy to do this. Second, God's never forgiven you of a sin more than once. Let me explain. God said, their sins and their iniquities I will remember no more. Once he forgives you of it, it's off the record. The next time you come to him is the first time you come to him. He is a father. I've told stories about being a father before. It's been my favorite part of my life, being a daddy. Now my kids are all big. But you know what? I'm still their daddy. They want anything, they got it. They make decisions I wouldn't have made. Yeah, sure, every day. But I love them. I live for that phone call. I live for that, hey, do you want to go out and have lunch? I live for this. I don't say, now, before we can have fellowship and lunch, I want to talk to you about some career moves you've made. No. I don't look at my son when he comes back from drill or comes back from an assignment or something and say, now, when you were with the Corps, did you say anything naughty? Because I'm pretty sure it happened. You almost never hear anybody kicking a door yelling, gee willikers. They are my children, and they will be my children. I love the idea of Jesus being a bridge. Think of this. To be a bridge, you need a minimum of two ends. If you only have one end, that's a non-bridge. That's a ski jump to doom. But it's not a bridge. Jesus has one foot in humanity, one in deity. He has one foot in eternity. He has one foot in time. He's perfect. Absolutely perfect for this. He also said, we can be saved to the uttermost. You know, it really bothers me. I'll go to places and say, how many of you know that if you died tonight, you'd go to heaven? And how few people raise their hand? And they'll say, well, you know, I just don't really know if I'm... How much... Who do you think you are that you can outsin his ability to forgive? Do you really think you've done something in your life that he didn't think about beforehand, before he made this plan? And he's up there and he goes, oh, we never thought of this. Cross isn't going to cover that one. Are you kidding me? I'm more saved than I need to be. I'm oversaved. And here's a cool thing. You and I now, we get to be bridge people. We get to be bridge people. We get to call people out of whatever storm and jungle they're in, whatever's chasing them, as we sang, whatever chains have been flung on them. We get to rescue them and get them on the bridge. And he'll get them home. This is no rope bridge. This is our opportunity to bring them home. The Celts were, they wrote about these missionaries that came to see them. And how in one generation, the entire nation of Ireland, which was not one nation, but over 300 tribes, each with their own king, all came to Jesus in one generation. And they talked about the people who came and loved them and served them. They referred to some as, for example, light bearers, because they brought in wisdom. They used their education to talk to them about how to raise children, how to have safer childbirth, how to dig their wells. You can do that. If you've got some knowledge, you can do this. If you're an engineer, you can do this. They talked about cross-bringers. Now, cross-bringers doesn't mean they brought the story of Jesus. In the Celtic way of thinking, it means they brought their cross with them. These were people who were willing to step into danger so that other people were okay. Think of firemen, nurses, EMTs, the military, policemen, people such as this, who stopped in Ireland slavery over 1,000 years before any other nation did. Because cross-bringers stepped in and said no. Who stopped the domestic violence that was rife in the Celtic tribes. Cross-bringers. But you also had friendship weavers. The Frithi Waib. The friendship weavers. These were the people, and I wish I was one of these, but I'm not. My wife is social and pleasant, and I'm not. I'm one of these that, you know, you basically I'm a doorstop. You bring me out, I do my job, you take me back. But there are people in congregations that when you walk in the door, they'll say, how you doing? And you can say, well, you know, I'm doing all right. And they'll say, you're not from here. And that's right. You know, where are you from? I'm from Detroit. And they'll say, well, you know, my husband's best friend actually knew a fellow whose second cousin shook hands with the guy from Detroit. And, you know, welcome home, you know, and they're flinging donuts at you, and they're bringing you around to friends, and here, look who's here. This is, what's your name? And before you leave, you've got 18 new best friends, and their emails are in your hands, and you're going, what happened? That's a friendship weaver. And the fourth one and last one, are the bridge people, they called them, were the Kaladi, the friends of God. These were the ones who, just being around them, you knew they knew this side of the bridge, and they knew him. And if they told you he would take you, you knew you could go. These are the St. Francis of Assisi. These are the Mother Teresa's. These are the people you have met that look like God with skin on, who just wrap you up in love and carry you onto the bridge. You are one of these if you wish to be. We are the bridge people. But whenever you talk to them, don't you dare tell them it's a perilous journey and the demons are out there. Yeah, the demons are out there. A whole lot of stuff is out there. In fact, nobody makes it through life alive. You're aware of this, right? Let me check my time. I got to explain that to you. I know statistics because I took it 3 times. I took it back BC before calculators. When all that you had were slide rules, which for those of you who don't know slide rules, these were druidic bones used by shaman. It had something to do with the worship of black framed glasses and duct tape as well, but I'm not really sure. You would ask it a question and you would manipulate the bones and cast them in certain ways. And I never really got it, quite frankly. Remember the teachers once started a question on a board there and they walked all the way around the room and finished the question over there. And the teacher said, is there any question about this? And all I could give was a strangled cry. He didn't even turn around. He goes, yes, Mr. Mead. I said, I don't know enough about what you just did to ask a question. So eventually he called me in his office. He goes, you're having trouble with statistics, aren't you? I said, oh, look at you. Give you a year and a half, you're right on top of something. Well done, Sherlock. And he sat me down and he goes, this is very simple. He brought out a deck of cards. And he goes, how many cards are there in a deck? I said, 52. I knew that because I'd been to college. He said, so what would be the odds of me cutting the deck and getting the ace of spades? I said, 50-50. He just looked at me. I said, either you will or you won't. He put his head on his desk and he gave me a C and I didn't have to come back to class anymore. So I'm not going to wow you with statistics, but I will give you that one. One out of one dies. So yeah, the journey we're on has its issues. Absolutely. But this is one thing you don't have to worry about. You can worry about finances and you can worry about the demons and you can worry about all kinds of things. Don't you dare worry about the love of Jesus Christ. We are bridge people. We're going to tell people, yeah, you're going to die. But then what? Are you going to be flicked off the bridge? Did you never get to a bridge? Are you still in the jungle? Or if you're on the bridge, when you die, all you're doing is stepping in where you always wanted to go anyway. Oh, please, I didn't want to be in this body for eternity. Are you kidding me? Somebody asked me that a couple of weeks ago. They said, you're middle-aged. And I went, no, because I'm 52. I'm not living to be 104. I'm over the hill. I can see the tunnel, and it looks beautiful. In heaven, I'm going to be muscular and brawny and hair sticking all over the place. You're going to look over there and say, who's that bronze God-looking creature? And I'm going to say, ah, it's me. You finally get your life. You finally get forgiven. You finally get saved. And people, you might think, I'm not worthy to be on this bridge. That's the point, isn't it? It's a point. All right, one more story. I got to go. Because you told me I did. True story, this comes out of the 60s. There was and I'm not exactly sure where in the 60s it was, but early 60s, I believe, where a high school did a design a house you'd like to live in one day competition. And this girl did it kind of, you know, for a bit of fun. And she won. And, yeah, it's very cool. Well, then they sent her to the county, which most counties back then had many schools instead of a big county school. And she went to that competition. She won. She won at the state competition. All of a sudden, she's gone from zero to hero. I mean, it's just, look at this girl, what she can do. She's 17 years old, and she's done this thing. She went to, now they got to send her to Washington, D.C. Now, this is back pre-internet and pre-mail and pre-cell phones and the like. This is no phone cards back then. You know, the only way they could get her was to put her on a bus. And the family couldn't go with her. They put her on the bus. But everybody's, yes, you'll win. Everybody says you're going to win. So she goes to D.C. and she competes against the other 50 people with Guam and all this other little guys there too. And they've got all their stuff in a cafeteria. And she didn't win. And she didn't get second or third. She didn't get honorable mention. She gets nothing. Everybody back home, you're winning, you're winning, you're winning. Now she's got to ride the bus home a day or so and tell them I got nothing. So she's sitting there not eating her lunch when an old man walks in. And she watches him as he looks at every one of the displays. And he comes back to hers. Now, he doesn't know her. He doesn't know she's sitting right there. Looks at hers again. And he mumbles to himself, I think this one's the best one. I think they missed it. And he walked out. And her life was forever changed because she recognized the man. It was Frank Lloyd Wright. And if he says, you're the best, you're the best. When you walk out of here, this world's going to tell you, you don't dress right, you don't have enough money, you're not getting enough sex, and you're not having enough pleasure in your life, and your Jesus isn't good enough, and this, that, and the other, and let them talk. Because Jesus says, come to the bridge, and he met you. And if he'll pay that price for you, he's not going to let you go that easy. Think on him. Be a bridge person. Don't trust the people in the world. They're going to change every time you turn around. But this is no rope bridge. This is a Son of God. And he says, come on. Enjoy the ride.